Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. One of my favorite YouTube channels is Sailor Sea Wild. It documents the work done by the Sea Doc Society, a collective of wildlife veterinarians, technicians, and scientists who explore the rich waters and coastlines of the Pacific Northwest. The Sailor Sea encompasses the waters of Puget Sound, the San Juan Islands, and the waters off Vancouver, British Columbia. It's one of the most diverse marine ecosystems on the planet. Along with its coastal rainforests, it's home to many amazing apex predators, from orcas in the ocean to grizzly bears, wolves, and eagles. Our guests know this region well and are excellent at bringing the amazing sights and sounds of the Sailor Sea to us via the Sailor Sea Wild YouTube channel. Joe Gatos is a wildlife veterinarian and the science director for the Sea Doc Society, which is a flagship program of the Karen C. Dreher Wildlife Health Center at the UC Davis School of Veterinary Medicine. Robert Friel is a cinematographer and the driving creative force behind the Sailor Sea Wild series on YouTube. Joe Gatos and Bob Friel, welcome back to Blue Dot.
Hey, Dave. Great to be here. Great to be back.
Yeah, thank you for having us, Dave.
Well, I'd like to know a little bit about, let's start out with you, Joe. Tell us what the Sea Doc Society actually is and where is the Sailor Sea?
Sea Doc Society is a marine science program that really works on conservation. So we're not just out there publishing papers. We're really trying to produce information that makes a change. And we're a program out of the vet school at UC Davis. And so just like people are interested in dog and cat health, or wild animal health, we're interested in wild animal health and ecosystem health. And so we're, our office, even though we work for UC Davis, we're based in the center of the Salish Sea on Orcas Island. And this is a 17,000 square kilometer inland sea shared by Washington and British Columbia. It's an incredible place to live.
Can you give us the geographic overview? Because I was talking to our producer, Matt Fidler, about, do you know where the Sailor Sea is? And he didn't really know. And I said, he started talking about the Puget Sound. I said, well, you know, that's what we're talking about. So give us a little geography lesson on the Sailor Sea.
Exactly. So imagine the Pacific Northwest corner of the United States, right where Washington State comes together with British Columbia. And Washington State is shaped a little bit like your right hand with a thumb sticking out. That's the Olympic Peninsula. And then up a little bit farther to the left is giant Vancouver Island. And this whole inland water that comes in from the Strait of Juan de Fuca goes all the way down to Seattle and Olympia, goes all the way north past the city of Vancouver up to Campbell River. This is an ocean that's, it's actually tied to the ocean, but it has big freshwater influences, big oceanic influences, and that mixing just makes this biological productivity that allows us to have things, three types of killer whales, nine different species of diving birds that kind of act like penguins, just everything you could imagine right here in our backyard.
It really is quite an amazing and beautiful place. You're so fortunate to live and work there. Bob, tell us about the series, Sailor Sea Wild, because it's really fun. It's really well done. Very engaging. How did it come about?
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate that you appreciate it. We work real hard on it. Well, see, you know, I started as a volunteer for Sea Doc just because I love their mission. It's everything that Joe is saying. And I was new to this area, coming from the East Coast of the U.S., and I've been a longtime scuba diver, a marine scientist, been into conservation, and just lucked into moving to an island, Orcas Island, in the San Juans, where this little organization was based, you know, underneath a giant organization down at UC Davis, but just this little office with Joe, and we became dive buddies. And part of my background had also been in magazine writing. I had done a little bit of little stint in television, so a lot of storytelling. And Joe and I would be out on boats, either doing research or just fun dives. And I kept saying, you know, this is a really cool place, and you have a really cool entree into this because you're a wildlife veterinarian working with these amazing animals. This would make a really fun video series. And it only took like 9 or 10 years. And Joe said yes. And, you know, it's really a dream for me kind of again, it was totally fortuitous that my background just kind of meshed with doing all of this. And, you know, I do have people that I knew back in TV days. It's like, oh, well, you're stuck. Your program, you named it Sailor Sea Wild. You can only deal with the Sailor Sea. What a dumb thing. And I'm like, you don't understand. The Sailor Sea goes from the top of the Cascade Mountains, the glaciers up there. All the glacier melt and everything pours down the stream. That's all the Salish Sea. And then it goes all the way out to the Pacific Ocean. So we have cougars and bears and orcas and humpbacks and basking sharks and ratfish and giant Pacific octopus. It is just, as far as being a filmmaker and someone who's interested in science, this, I couldn't imagine being in a better place to do the series. So we came up with this, and it serves CDOC's message to take that science and put it in a presentable way and get it out to the people to make that positive change that we want.
Yeah, that ecosystem, those ecosystems that you have up there are so diverse, and there's so many different types of places and the wildlife that you could literally spend, you know, a lifetime and not cover all of it, I would think, Joe.
Exactly.
That's what we're thinking, too.
Yeah. We'll talk about some recent episodes soon, but how do you come to the conclusion, like, we're going to do an episode about this?
Yeah, so Bob and I early on made a spreadsheet that, you know, we had to do an 8-point font because it was so big and so long of all the different ideas. And, you know, he's listed off a bunch of them previously. And then laid on top of that are certain things that happen maybe only 2 weeks out of the year. So if there's a herring spawn, or there's a migratory bird stopover, or there's an opportunity with a researcher that's going out to put, you know, tags on animals. And so we kind of lay things out seasonally, but then we also overlay them with opportunities that come up along the way.
Yeah, we like to, one of our favorite things is, you know, CDOC, Joe, and we have Kat Lowe. We have researchers with CDOC who are part of programs. And then CDOC also takes some of the donor money and funds other studies that are going on. They have this thing every year where they, I think it's five, they kind of give out scholarships to other researchers who are doing important things for the health of the wildlife and the health of the ecosystem in the Salish Sea. So every time Joe is working on that and it's coming up in the year, I'm always bugging him saying, Joe, you got to pick ones that look good on film. So the ideal episode for us is something that it's some cutting edge, important science going on that CDOC is directly involved in or funding and, you know, has something charismatic with it. And then there's other things that are just, you know, a recent one on grizzly bears. I just love grizzly bears, and I've traveled all over to see them, and you can find them in the Salish Sea. Of course, then we go and that's not really a story. Here's one of Bob's favorite animals. So then the job is to find out, you know, what really, how does this really tie into the ecosystem and what important stuff is going on right now with that? But yeah, there's endless stories up here.
Well, let's talk about that grizzly bear episode, because I saw that one and found it to be really fascinating. And grizzly bears to me, you know, they're probably the apex predator on Earth as far as land mammals. They're just, they're magnificent animals, and they scare the crap out of me, frankly. It's like, if I were to see a black bear in the wild, it's like, oh, cool, a bear. If I were to see a grizzly bear, I'd be like, I'm going to die.
You're a smart man, Dave. Yeah.
So let's talk about that episode, because you did, you know, some amazing work there, Joe. And what I really enjoyed was your guide and the place you went to. Emily LaFontaine, I believe, was her name. And she just seemed like an amazing person. Tell us about her and the place you went.
She was incredible. And so Bob found the place. Bob, do you want to tell him a little bit just about how you were working with this grizzly researcher and recommended that?
Yeah, just it started with the, you know, I have this circle of friends who are into conservation of various animals and would just happen to be talking to them. And said, you know, I really love grizzly bears, and it's a shame. I do this show, Salish Sea Wild, and there's none here, I don't think. And happened to know a guy who, right after he got his doctorate, was on his first field work, and he was a bear scientist, and he got attacked by a grizzly and a really serious injury, but he survived. And he stayed. That even made him more pro-bear. But he's like, oh, no, I know a place that, because, again, the Salish Sea is everything that feeds into it. It's on a fjord coming down from the mountains that feeds into the Salish Sea. So we identified that, and it's like, yeehaw, we can do grizzly bears.
Then we get up there, Dave, and the place is exceptional. It's just what we were thinking the Salish Sea must look like at the beginning. I mean, just the trees coming right down to the water, humpback whales, killer whales, Pacific white-sided dolphin on the way coming in, this beautiful forest. And then when we get our guide, we have this phenomenal woman shows up who's been guiding for multiple years in the area, Emma LaFontaine. She's Canadian. She's from Montreal, moved over to the West Coast to get her degree in wildlife. And she had been there long enough that she actually knew, she'd been working with a researcher, so she knew the animals individually. She could tell by just looking at their face. She knew their habits. She took us out moving through the forest in their territory in a way that we felt comfortable, safe, not impacting the movements of the animals. And most of the time we spent, actually all the time, right, Bob? We were with moms and cubs, which is the group that scares me the most.
Sure. Oh, yeah.
Right. Right. That's the common knowledge, right? The one thing you do not want to run into, especially with, you know, there's always the differences between the bears, black bears, that if it's coming at you, it's more likely to be a predatory attack. So that's why they say always fight a black bear. Grizzly bears are usually defensive because they're not really hunting humans most of the time. So, but what you don't want to be near is a mother with cubs. And yeah, that's what we were with the entire time. And the interesting thing, or a great thing about, you know, if you watch the episode, Joe's walking through the woods and everything, but she was so great and so cautious. Like the scene where you see Emma and Joe walking through the forest, she was nervous because I was in front of them to get the shot. And she wanted to be in the front at all times to be the one who encountered anything first. But I was walking backwards behind them. But so, yeah, as Joe said, we felt really, really good to be with her. And there's nothing, you can tell professionals when they're working around. I used to work with sharks a lot. And it's the same thing with the bear people or cougar people or these scientists and guides who are out there working with them when they're bringing people in. You can really tell a professional. In Africa on safaris, it's the same exact thing. The people that you want, somebody who really respects the animals and knows what they can do. So even though they're around them all the time, if a mother was within 50 yards, you know, as we were getting out of the boat, we wouldn't get out of the boat. So you really feel like you're in safe hands when you're with a professional organization like that. And I don't know if we mentioned it. The place is called Night Inlet Lodge.
One of the things I love about that episode is you and your narration, Joe, because you were whispering, and I thought that was kind of cool because it. And you also talked about, you know, making sure you don't have scents. Talk us about some of the safety tips when you are in grizzly country.
Right, when we got there, it was really clear from the start. Like, you do not wear deodorant. You do not bring food in your pocket. You do not. I think even Bob wrote it into the script. You know, Old Spice is not a cologne. It's a spice for them.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they know we're there and they know how many people are there. They, you know, as Bob said, they know what we had for breakfast yesterday, but we don't want them to see us as a source of food or any sort of opportunity. And they were very clear about that. They were very clear that we were there to watch, not to interfere. And so when we were doing stand-ups, we had to whisper out of respect from, you know, for the bears themselves to not disturb them. And so, you know, Bob was smart, mic'd me up tight at the beginning, but that the whole episode really occurred in a very quiet way like that.
Well, it added to the whole Heart of Darkness primordial vibe of the the episode. It was just very engaging. And you know what I really liked about it in all of your shows is how it teaches you about the connections of ecosystems, because it was about, you know, those bears are there for a reason. They are waiting for the salmon to come in. And I think sometimes people don't understand how important it is when you have salmonids, when you have fish that are coming in from the ocean inland, you know, through the ecosystem on the river, they are bringing those ocean nutrients into that ecosystem. And the bears are, you know, of course, a big part of that. So talk a bit about the importance of the connection between salmon and the rest of the forest.
Yeah, that was, I mean, that was our top line in our episode list was the bear's connection, the salmon connection to the bears in the forest. And we went up there exactly at a certain week, and we expected to be flush with salmon, right? That's why the bears come down into that inlet, into the estuary, because it should have been filled with salmon at that time. So we get up there, and it was a little bit of a, you know, as far as producing and writing the thing, oh, there's no salmon. So there goes our whole story. So fortunately, our entire crew is me and Joe. So we kind of rewrote and came up with the concept for the show while we're there, which of course is more poignant because there were no salmon there. So what does that do to the bears? And what does that do to the forest? And we got to go through that entire connection that the bears are now, you know, as far as filmmaking, you have a ticking clock, right? They are going to hibernate. And especially since all we saw were mothers with cubs, the mother not only has to have enough body fat to get her through the winter, but if she has cubs of the year that were born that spring, or even 2-year-olds who still go into the den with her, they nurse all winter. So they can be okay, but the mother has to have enough fat to, again, keep herself alive and be able to get out of the den at the end and to produce that milk for the cubs. So it really became a poignant thing that we would watch, we would see when we went in the boats up in the streams, we saw the bears coming down. So they're coming down the stream to again look for salmon. And they were sniffing, they're looking all over. And usually at this time of the year, there'd even be dead salmon on the banks, but there'd be lots of live ones. They were looking in that. The cubs are learning what's mom looking for. And then they would kind of reluctantly go into the sedge and then just start eating sedge because they had to pack on calories. But it's just a much more efficient thing to eat the fish. And if the salmon don't show up, the bears don't get it. The cubs, there's a good chance of cub mortality over the winter. The mothers might not even make it. But the carry-on from that is the bears eat the salmon. The bears poop along the salmon bank, along the bank. They poop into the woods. It feeds the trees. It feeds the birds. It feeds the insects that then feed the salmon, you know, when they hatch from the nests that the salmon are returning. So it's this entire cycle, and it's all with the salmon. And everything in this ecosystem in the Northwest and in British Columbia and in Alaska is tied to the salmon. That is the driver of everything because they're born in freshwater. They go out into the ocean where there's a different kind of productivity. They're getting all those fats, all those nutrients out there. And then they bring it back into this freshwater system and then distribute it there. So you're getting marine derived nutrients put into a freshwater system. And without the salmon, we wouldn't have any of this.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us as we continue our conversation with Joe Gatos and Bob Friel as we talk about their latest work producing the YouTube channel Salish Sea Wild for the Sea Doc Society. I'm Dave Shlohm, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. If you're just joining us, our guests are Joe Gatos and Bob Friel. Joe is a wildlife veterinarian and the science director for the Sea Doc Society, which is part of the UC Davis School of Veterinary Medicine. Bob Friel is a cinematographer and the creative force behind the Salish Sea Wild YouTube channel. The Salish Sea is the inland sea encompassing Puget Sound, the San Juan Islands, and the waters off Vancouver, British Columbia. Okay, let's talk about another episode that I really loved. I thought it would be interesting, started to watch, and was like, wow, this is fascinating. Tell us about the Sandpipers of Roberts Bank and why that's such a special place.
So this is one of those things, Dave, that really only happens a couple weeks out of the year. And Bob and I had been thinking about this place for a long time. Some of these Western sandpipers, these are really tiny little birds. They weigh about as much as a quarter, about 25 grams. And some of these birds are flying from Peru all the way up to Alaska to breed. And, you know, they have a really great frequent flyer program, but no snacks allowed on those flights. And so they're needing to stop at these important places to fatten up along the way just to make it up to their breeding grounds. And this is one of those specific sites that we wanted to visit.
And tell us about Bob, because he was pretty amazing and how he'd kind of figured out what they were doing there.
Yeah, I had starting this one, you know, what we had, again, on our list wasn't sandpipers. We had biofilm, which is slime. And we knew we wanted to do an episode because as scientists, we know how important this is. And but, you know, in order to do a video, you need something a little more charismatic than slime. So we started thinking about it, and then sandpipers. Okay, so everybody loves sandpipers. They're the cutest bird in the world. One of the cutest, and the entire population of Western sandpipers. So every one of this bird on Earth stops at these little slimy sandbanks on their way up to nest in the tundra. And if they don't stop there, they don't make it up there, they don't produce, and they go away. So we started doing research on that, and it's like, okay, so it's in the Salish Sea. Why is this so important? What is it that is good for these birds? And I start talking to scientists. And the other part was there was a little bit of controversy. So I kind of get the journalist tingles going because Canada has plans to do this large port expansion right on top of Roberts Bank. And so, oh, that's going to disturb this. What will it be? So I start talking to scientists, legitimate scientists who are working up there, and they kind of say, well, yeah, it's okay, this, but it's shallow and the same conditions. And, you know, if they build the port and they dump some sand or mud over here, that'll be shallow and biofilm will grow there and the birds will be fine. And I'm like, okay. And they send me a bunch of papers, and I called Joe after reading some of them. I'm like, something's fishy here. Something's not quite right with what they're telling me. I mean, everything, you know, as marine scientists, you know about diatoms, which are basically the most important thing on Earth, right? They give us our oxygen, they're big carbon sinks in the ocean. They feed everything because they have this wonderful thing. They're an algae and they photosynthesize. But when they, unlike most of our plants, when they take that energy, they don't store it as carbohydrates. They store it as lipids, as fats, as polyunsaturated fatty acids, right? The miracle molecule that we should all have more of. So this is a really efficient thing for birds or fish or crab larvae or whatever to eat. So that's what these diatoms make. But we have such different systems here in the Salish Sea, and right where Roberts Bank is where the Fraser River comes out through Vancouver, and that's the biggest projector of fresh water and nutrients and stuff into the Salish Sea. So, and we know all about from our dives around here how you can go right around the corner of an island or something, and you have these, you know, like microclimates, but they're microsystems because things are affected by different things. So I, you know, Joe says, yeah, that doesn't sound right. So, you know, dig some more. So I get a hold of this guy named Bob Elner, who was a Brit, but he upgraded to Canadian later. And he was a great scientist because I loved, like, his first notable early work was very Darwinian, and it was on sandpipers over in Europe, a different species of sandpiper, where they saw them in biofilm, in slime, and they're like, oh, well, they're just hunting these little clams and stuff that are down there. And that's what people had accepted, that not that fact, which wasn't a fact, for a long, long time. And he said, wait a second, this is anaerobic. There's none of their clams in there. So maybe they're eating this biofilm, and the other scientists, oh, maybe it's an accident. Well, he, just like Darwin with his finch, is saying, oh, I know one's going to have a longer tongue, or the tongue this long or something, or a beak this long, rather. So he went in, and he and some colleagues took an electron microscope and looked at the tongue of the sandpiper. And here it is, evolved specifically to eat this biofilm. And so that was a great thing. I'm like, oh, Bob, you are our guy. He sounds really good. And then we start talking about the controversy. And it's like, well, I hear that, you know, it's not really a big deal if they put the port there because there'll be other biofilm. And he's like, wrong. And then, you know, the spider sense had kind of worked. He goes, the Fraser River, when it comes in at this certain time of the year, when you have the glaciers melting, when you have all this stuff going on, you have this amount of sunlight, you have these tides, those diatoms get shocked. And my favorite thing for episodes is if we can somehow get the scientific concept we're trying to do, and I can have Joe somehow illustrate that. So when Bob Elner said they're shocked, this biofilm gets shocked, and when they're under stress, they produce more of those polyunsaturated fatty acids, that superfood. And it turns out that that's what the birds need specifically in their muscles to make it up to the tundra. And it's only the biofilm that gets hit by this Fraser water. So you can have biofilm wherever you want, but it's only this stuff that gets shocked. And I'm like, oh, that's great. What can we do to show Joe getting shocked? And I thought about a taser. That was my first thought, was hitting him with a taser. But then since we're on the water, I came up with something else. And Joe can tell you that. I don't know how happy he was with that, but it worked.
Yeah. How did you get shocked?
Yeah, I was not happy about this, Dave. So the water here can be anywhere from a chilly 55 degrees down to a chilly 45 degrees Fahrenheit. And Bob says, you know, the easiest thing to do basically is to chuck you into the water and have you have a cold shock and then talk through it. And I thought, gosh, I have trouble memorizing lines as it is. You know, I'm going to be freezing cold, trying to drown and have to eke out some lines. I said, yeah, what could go wrong? Let's definitely do this here.
Hi, this is Joe Gatos with the Sea Doc Society. Let's talk about the physiological effects of
shock. Let's talk about shock. This is temperature shock, 48 degree water. Right now, my body is going through a series of neurogenic, cardio, and respiratory changes. Known in layperson's terms as, I'm freezing my buns off.
I did, just because we are friends, I did. That was, I think that was the most GoPros and other cameras we had set up, because I really wanted it to be one take.
Yes.
Just because Joe sometimes does.
Oh, the battery died. Joe, you got to do it again.
Yeah. I knew this would not be, you know, Joe's nickname is Joe Six Takes. And I'm like, Joe will not survive six takes of this.
Hypothermia death after the third take.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So we did get it done in one.
Well,
so that
what
was great.
Really, you know, what struck me about that episode, even before you told us, the viewers, about this development of the port, that at the end was like, oh my gosh, I had this sense like, this place is so special for these birds that if you take it away, this is evolved for, you know, millennia for them, depending on this one spot for this biofuel to get, you know, enough in the tanks to make it up to the tundra. I was like, oh my gosh, this is a very fragile situation.
Yeah. And you know what's really, you know, there's things now where people are looking back, talking about climate change and, oh, well, look at this graph. Oh, it's been much warmer and blah, 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 and all this. And, oh, the salmon have gone up and down. What people need to really understand, and that this is a good example of it. So, yeah, if it was a natural process, if the tides changed or the flow of the Fraser changed slowly and moved those sandbars, the biofilm, you know, the birds would evolve a little bit. The biofilm would change. There would be some more that was suitable. You know, the salmon, if the water temperature slowly raised over 1,000 years, they would, you know, the water flow would change. They would use different streams. What people don't get is that the human impact is too fast for all of these things. That's the whole thing about climate change and ocean acidification, overfishing or anything. Yeah, there is resiliency out there. Evolution happens. Things will survive, but we change things too fast. And that's the problem with the port. That's why you could kind of see that coming, that these birds, you know, oh, gee, this is fragile. And if something changes too quickly for them to adapt, they're in big trouble.
And it's interesting, Dave, that you brought up this idea about a special place, because, you know, we have National Register of Historic Places. We have places that we want to protect. What, they're 50 years, buildings that they're 50 years old or 100 years old or things like that. We don't have a good international way of legally protecting high value sites like that. So, you know, every single Western sandpiper in the world is stopping there over a couple week period. There are 30 species of shorebirds that stop in that Fraser Delta. But where people look at it and say, oh, it's just mud. You know, so it really takes trying to tell a story, and that's Bob's gift, is to make it interesting, make a story, make people love it, And then they're willing to protect it. Then they're willing to make a phone call to say, hey, we want to save this place. It's more than just a muddy area.
Let's talk about whales. One of my favorite species of whales are the gray whales that we have here in California that migrate. I grew up watching them and taking my little skiff out into the Pacific Ocean and having them swim by. It was just always wonderful to see them. You did an episode about some gray whales that take a very interesting detour. Tell us about how you stumbled into that story.
I'll take that, Joe.
Yeah. So these gray whales, as you alluded to in your intro there, Dave, is they have their babies down in these calving lagoons off of Baja California. So it's relatively warm water. It's relatively protected. And then they're moving their calves all the way up the coast of California, Oregon, Washington, BC, up to Alaska, where they're putting on huge amounts of fat. And so they bring their calves up there. And then at the end of the summer feeding season, they make this migration all the way back again. So it's an incredible feat in itself. They are getting challenged because of changes in sea ice pack and the sort of algae that grows underneath of the sea ice. And we've had some episodes over the last few decades where we've had massive die-offs of gray whales, just basically littering the beaches. And there's a place here in the Salish Sea, it's hidden behind an island. Again, one of these shallow, relatively sandy, muddy bottom areas that turns out is a really important place to fatten up gray whales along the migration because it's chock-a-block full of these little shrimp, these little ghost shrimp. And so Bob and I were kind of talking about how amazing that was. And we were lucky enough to hook up with a scientist, several scientists actually, that were doing some work. How many ghost shrimp are there? How are they fattening up? How often are they diving? And then even had the history of how, pretty much the history of how the gray whales discovered this area and then used it to their advantage. It was amazing.
And how did they discover this area?
Well, it's interesting. The first whale that they named who came in, and of course, gray whales like humpbacks, you identify them by the spots on their tails and by their dorsal fin and scars and things like that. They nicknamed her Earhart, for Amelia Earhart, because, you know, she was an explorer. It was a female. And, you know, Joe mentioned these more big mortality events. The really interesting thing about this is that once Earhart came in, then they noticed a couple whales, you know, it wasn't exactly linear, but then it got up to a dozen, maybe a couple more, and it changes each year. But what they discovered was that the whales who did stumble in here were being taught by the other whales who were already here how to do this feeding thing on this ghost shrimp. And so these are 50-foot whales. You know, you've seen these giant devilfish, and they're going into water where, you know, their fins are out of the water. It's like they're waving to you. You can see part of their body. They're in very shallow water. And if they got stuck, you know what happens to whales when they get stuck. It's really hard to get themselves off. So Earhart, being the brilliant one, I guess, figured out that she had to do it on a rising tide. And then the same scientists put suction cup video cameras and time depth recorders on her. And they actually got footage of other whales following her in. She knew to wait for a rising tide. She would go in. A lot of gray whales do go into the sand, kind of lie on their side and then chomp down on a big, huge mouthful of sand and then strain it through. So that they're built to do that. But they don't do that usually in shallow water like this. And then she taught them, and I guess they taught others. And now there's a dozen of these whales. And during these huge mortality events where, Joe can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's up to 40% of the population of the Eastern Pacific gray whales have, or maybe it's 20 or 40, it's a large number of whales that die during these mortality events that have happened over the decades. This strategy of stopping, again, they're heading to the Arctic. That's where all of the whales are going. It's only these who became nicknamed the Sounders for Puget Sound who take this huge detour. I mean, it's not a short detour. They swim all the way in the Strait of Juan de Fuca, all the way to the mainland, right there at Everett, looking for, you know, and hunting and eating these ghost shrimp. At the time we did the episode, not a single one of them had died during these mortality events. So just the fact that they learned to come in and then taught other whales to come in here and eat this, eat these ghost shrimp, has protected them from that. So it was a really important thing that is just one of these wonders of how animals, again, can be resilient. So we have issues going on in the Arctic. These guys, by having this strategy, learning this very kind of dangerous feeding strategy, but it's been worth it to them to protect them.
Yeah, one of the oh wow moments for me on that film was when the tide went out and you showed where the whales had been feeding and you see these just huge craters. That was just like, wow, look at what they've been doing.
Yeah, those were where they were feeding is this muck that is where these ghost shrimp live. So we had been out with the whales. We saw them feeding from the boat. So we saw them, you know, with their fins up above the water. And it's like, wow, I really want to see what the ghost shrimp look like. I had never seen a ghost shrimp. And we want to see what this was like. And we have these huge tidal ranges at that time of year. So we decided to go out there. And it's big muck. It's nasty. And what I did not know about Joe until right at the very end of this is that he had a deep-seated fear of something in particular. And I'll throw that to you, Joe.
Yeah, Bob was really smart. He had a friend who lived on this island, Kameno Island. And he said, can you take us out there? He said, sure. So we met him at the beach. He walks this very circuitous route to get out to these feeding pits. And this was a really low tide, like a minus 2 or 3 foot tide. And these pits are huge, 10, 20 feet across. Birds will come in, you know, when the water's still shallow and the whales are making them, and use them as a place to get food. And so we dug up some ghost shrimp. We got some video. We did some stand-up. We talked with some other researchers that were out there. And we said, okay, this is a wrap. Let's start heading back. And so, you know, I'm hungry because I haven't eaten in an hour or maybe 2 hours, which is really long time for me. And so I just start to beeline it back. And of course, not even thinking that our guide was already gone and did not take us on the direct route. And then all of a sudden, Bob and I both sank up to our armpits. And as Ooh. A kid, I don't know why, they never made us afraid of nuclear war or any of these important things, but they put the fear of God in us about
quicksand.
So Bob and I are, you know, deep up, and we've got gear up, holding it out of there. And we finally get out, and Bob says, you know, I appreciate you telling me, just breathe. You know, you're not going to die. And I'm like, Bob, I wasn't talking to you. I was talking to myself.
Yeah, that's scary. That's scary. We're going to take a short break, but stay with us as we continue our conversation with Joe Gatos and Bob Friel from the YouTube channel Salish Sea Wild. We're talking about their work for UC Davis's Sea Doc Society in the Salish Sea off Washington and British Columbia, home of one of the world's largest and most diverse marine ecosystems. I'm Dave Schloem, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's continue now as we talk to Joe Gatos and Bob Friel from the Sea Doc Society about their latest work on the YouTube channel Salish Sea Wild. I never realized that there were beavers that were operating, you know, in the salty part of the estuary. Tell us about those beavers, because that was really interesting.
You're not the only one, Dave, because it's only been in the last 10 to maybe 15 years that scientists have really understood that they can occur in these semi-salty or what we call estuary type waters. And there was one scientist who was out, he's not a, you know, wildlife biologist, he's really a plant guy. And he was out studying these estuaries and he kept seeing these things. And he said, you know, these don't look natural. They don't look man-made, they're weird. And he discovered that they're actually beaver dams, but they don't look like the kind that you would see when you're, you know, in the backcountry of, you know, the northern parts of Canada or something like that. They're very small dams, and he couldn't figure out why these animals are making dams in an area that's going to be flooded with 10 to 12 more feet of water. And so he published a paper, and then this is one of those examples that Bob alluded to where CDOC funded him to go back out and start studying these animals. How do they move? How many of them are there? you know, what do they do to benefit things like salmon?
Yeah, it was really interesting to me to think about the benefits that beavers bring to a place like that, just like everything. But I'd never thought about, wow, you know, beavers as engineers that were creating salmon habitat.
Yeah, we all think, oh, beavers. I hate to say this, but I was like, beavers are kind of boring. Because we know, you know, there have been documentaries about beavers forever. But finding out that they were in this estuary, and yeah, the visual of they're building dams, and you think, oh, they build a dam to make a lake, and that's what our normal thing is, and then they have a lodge. These guys can't do that because the tide is so high. So when they build their dam, all they're doing, because the dam at high tide will be underwater by 6 or 8 feet. So it's going over there, and it makes no sense. It's like, well, this doesn't do. But then you find out that really they're doing that for transportation. So they'll do it to make a lake or a pond and put their house in there. But then when they eat all of the trees in that pond, they start to make these channels. And then what that does is get them safely to a new food source. So that's kind of what's happening on here. They're just transportation channels that would save them so they can swim, stay in the water. You know, if coyotes or something comes out there, they won't get them. So it was amazing. And then when the scientists went back and did a little, you know, I think they were thinking about some estuary fish. I know eventually it became salmon, but that was kind of the real shock, is that when he did his first seining behind one of these at low tide. So you're not saving a huge amount of water, just enough for a beaver to swim through and stay safe from predators. So you've got, you know, 18 inches, 2 feet, 3 feet of water at some of them. But he was finding, Joe, what was it, 10 times as many salmon?
I think at least 3 times as many Chinook, which are these, endangered salmon. And it was allowing, because otherwise those areas would have been completely dried out. So it gave the Chinook a place to hang out. They need a lot of oxygen in the water, and they need a place where they're not going to get eaten by a kingfisher or a great blue heron or something like that. So these beavers were inadvertently making sanctuaries to help us recover Chinook salmon.
Yeah, they're creating these wonderful rest stops for the salmon, for them to go have a place to hang out, you know, eat a little something and rest.
Right. And then when the tide comes back in, they can swim over the dam and make it down to the next rest stop and, refuel, go in, use the bathroom, get something to eat. You know, it's sort of like, you know, our rest stops that our dad never let us stop at when we were on the turnpike because it cost money.
Yeah, and it's even more than that. Without these beavers, there wouldn't be that habitat. So there's one of the main limiting factors we have for salmon here is that habitat that has been taken up by stuff that's been dammed and diked for farms and stuff. You lose that rearing habitat. You know, the salmon don't want to be flushed directly down from the freshwater into the saltwater. They need this area to smoltify, to kind of go from a freshwater fish to a saltwater fish. They need to, the larger they are when they enter the marine ecosystem, the higher their survivability will be. So that's why, you know, putting culverts and things like that bring back the not really nursery grounds, but growing grounds, you know, grow out places for these things. So without these beavers, there wouldn't be that habitat. So whatever number of Chinook that we have that are surviving, part of that number is because of these beavers. And that was totally unknown. So it was like all along, we've had the beavers helping us try to recover salmon, and we didn't know about it. So it was a cool thing to find out.
Yeah, it's just amazing to me, or as Joe would put it, damn. When you think about beavers, you know, just
we did get to play with that a lot.
Which brings me to one of my favorite things about the series is that you use humor so well. It's fun. It's engaging. You know, there are some heavy topics that you get into that we've discussed about, you know, threats to these wonderful ecosystems. But you use humor so effectively. Tell us a bit about, you know, how fun it is to do those moments, Joe.
I love it. I mean, it brings Bob and I back to our inner fifth grader. And we've talked with you about this before, Dave. You know, when we were kids, we were out running in the creek and in the woods. We laughed, we played, we found awe with the natural world that was out there. We felt a need to take care of it. And I am right back in that world as a fifth grader every time we go out and do something. I'm just, my mind is blown away by the remarkable things that we're able to see and do. And it just brings me so much joy. It's impossible to not have fun doing it.
And Bob, tell us a bit about, you know, the creative side of, because it's not, being funny isn't something you just, hey, go be funny.
No. It's anyone who's had the mixed pleasure of being in my company knows that humor is kind of the default. So whatever I'm doing, I kind of look for the humor in it. And I've done that. That has gone through all of my work, whether in books or magazine articles or TV or something like that. So I just have to go to that. The deeper part of that I think works for a show like this is that, so we're out there doing it. Like you said, we're covering heavy subjects. There is, especially right at this particular moment, things are terrible for science. We work with a lot of the people we work with have been laid off. You know, funding has been taken away. There's stuff that we work on that had been federally funded that has been taken away. So it's kind of a scary time for science, for facts, for all this stuff. But I've never found doom and gloom to be a motivating factor. Mine is more anger, but that also doesn't make a good TV show.
That's because you're Irish, Bob.
It makes good podcasts and stuff like that. But I couldn't maintain that. I don't want to do an angry nature show. But humor, even when we're dealing with these subjects, I mean, for one, that's again my default for any kind of teaching or speaking. I think it lands better with people. You know, humor is simply connecting things that you might not think about at first, and you connect it in a way and people go, oh, and it makes a little, you get a little hormone thing, you know, shooting through. It's like, oh, that's funny. That's great. So people tend to remember that.
It tends more to break down barriers.
It does. It breaks down barriers. It gives you a universal thing. You know, we all think certain things are funny. So you're looking for that kind of connection. When I can connect it to a scientific fact, like making Joe jump in and Joe is shocked and, you know, we found that funny. Joe didn't find it funny, but then
I'm still looking for the humor there, but
that connected, or Joe eating tons of shrimp and the gray whales eating tons of shrimp. Those are elements. And I also feel that, especially because we know we are dealing with the audience, you know, impressionable, whether it's kids or people who don't know about this, people in the region who, you know, haven't yet gotten the appreciation for some of these things that are going on. If we can do it with humor, and we're the ones out there doing this and being with the people who are doing this really important work, I kind of, in my mind, I'm thinking that if they're seeing us have fun, things are not as bleak as they might think they are from reading headlines. And the worst thing that would happen for any of our conservation movement, any of this wildlife safety, is if people gave up. And if it's all doom and gloom, then just for your own mental health, you have to give up, right? So we're seeing this. We know that things can get better. And, you know, that's kind of the thing that we carry with us. So, you know, using the humor to me works on a number of levels like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And one, I want to know an inside story of filmmaking and humor is there's a moment during the Beaver episode where you're doing your best Yul Gibbons. Ever eat a pine tree? Some parts are edible.
Doesn't look too appetizing, but to a beaver, this is breakfast. Not too bad. Probably very high in fiber.
You're gnawing on a tree and you've got a mouthful of wood chips. I'm thinking, what did you do there? Did you have the wood chips hidden and then you stuck them in your mouth, or had them in your mouth and spat them out? How'd that work?
I had, you know, I thinking of beavers and how we were going to play with this. And here's what we know about beavers. They eat wood, right? So in the back of my mind, I was thinking, all right, I've got to have Joe chew on sticks or something like that. And maybe I can make some breadsticks that look like sticks. And we went out to shoot the intro stand-ups. And it's a beaver that lives here right on Orcas Island. And we went there. And so we shot the stand-ups. And I'm looking at this tree that he had knocked down into the water. And it was very fresh. So all of the chips were gathered around the base. So after we shot this stand-up, I'm like, you know, Joe, you know, it would be funny. So gnaw on that. And Joe gnawed on it for a little bit. And I'm like, yeah, that looked pretty good. But can you do me a favor? So we grabbed a big handful of those chips. I said, stick these in your mouth and then gnaw on them and spit them out. And it actually, I thought it looked really good.
Now you've ruined the movie magic. I thought Joe actually chewed that tree down.
Joe has some teeth on him. I mean, Joe has teeth, but I didn't want to. I also know his dentist, so I didn't want to get him in trouble. So
one of the things I love about Joe is he's not above like sticking weird slimy things in his mouth from the ocean.
I will do anything necessary, whether it's the biofilm or the alder tree, whatever. This is the best cause out there.
That is awesome. Well, Joe Gatos and Bob Friel, always a joy to talk to you and have you on the program. The hosts of Salish Sea Wild and the Sea Doc Society's great work. Just thanks so much for joining us and all that you do. It's a really fun series to watch.
Thank you, Dave.
Thank you, Dave.
Thanks again to our guests, Joe Gatos, Science Director and Wildlife Veterinarian for the Sea Doc Society based on Orcas Island, and his friend and videographer, Bob Friel. Together, they produce the content for the YouTube channel Salish Sea Wild. You can see their latest episodes there and learn more about the Sea Doc Society, a flagship program of the Karen C. Dreher Wildlife Health Center at the UC Davis School of Veterinary Medicine, at seadocsociety.org. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of Chico State Enterprises and licensed to California State University, Chico, in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.